Hey, everybody. Welcome to Movie Crush, Friday interview edition. Charles W. Chuck Bryant here, doing the intro and outro in our home studio, Ponce City Market. But this one was recorded at our Hollywood studios in Hollywood, California. Everyone, I had Jordan Morris on to talk about Point Break. Jordan is an old pal that I met through, met at Max FunCon. Our friend Jesse Thorne, mutual friend that Jordan has known since college, and they actually started out in college together doing comedy. You get to hear this backstory too, which is really fun, doing college radio together. And they are still working together on Jordan Jesse Go, the great podcast on the Max Fun Network. Jordan is also the creator and head writer and showrunner for Bubble, the wonderful comedy sci-fi kind of bonzo fun scripted podcast that came out last year. Hopefully Bubble 2 will be coming out sometime soon. Really, really good stuff. Check it out if you haven't. But Jordan's a great guy, and it was a lot of fun sitting down and talking Point Break with him. Such a fun, fun movie. So without any delay, everyone, here is Jordan Morris on Point Break. Where do you live right now?
West Hollywood.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. This was not a hard drive at all.
Yeah, that's good. I stay when I come here at this place, like right around the corner, so it's really cool.
Cool.
It's a dumb, glitzy hotel, but hey, it's like 500 feet away.
Nothing wrong with that.
So it's kind of good.
Yeah, that's awesome.
I've gotten to know the Hollywood Boulevard well.
Are you guesting on anybody's show while you're out here?
No.
Cool.
No, I didn't put the word out.
Yeah.
I'd still love to do JJ Go at some point.
Yeah, next time you're in town. Yeah,
well, I'll definitely be coming back in June for Max Fun.
Oh, cool. Yeah, let's definitely do it.
And I usually come out Thursday. When do you guys record?
We usually record Sunday, but I think we could make an exception.
Or
maybe
Sunday.
You could be our guest at Max Fun Con if we tape live.
Oh, goodness.
Anyway.
Well, hey.
Well,
let's park that to the side.
Of course. No need to get our calendars out now.
I don't want you to write any checks that
that's true.
Jesse doesn't want to cash. It's funny, man. All these 80s movies this week. It's weird.
Interesting.
Well, technically Point Break is 90s.
Yeah, 91.
Yeah. Where are you from originally?
Orange County.
Oh, I didn't know you were semi-local.
Yeah, I mean, I was born in Beaumont, Texas, but we moved to Orange County, California when I was like three. So uh-huh. I kind of consider that to be where I was born and raised.
So you don't relate to Texans?
Not really. I mean, we went out there for like our family vacations uh-huh. and stuff. And my like, you know, my mom's sisters still live out there.
Right.
My mom's sisters, it does. And so my cousins live out there. So I like have fondness for Texas.
Right.
And certainly, you know, love any excuse to go to Austin for work because it is
yeah.
the world's funnest place.
It is fun.
But yeah, no, I consider myself a chill SoCal local.
A chill SoCal. Mm-hmm. The OC local.
Hanging 10. Smoking dubs, you know, the OC way, baby.
You don't do either one
being
of those
being weirdly
things, do
religious.
You might as well be one of the ex-presidents.
Yeah.
Do you have siblings and stuff?
I have a little sister who is now 30. Right. So a 30-year-old little – it's weird to call a 30-year-old your little sister.
How old
yes,
are you now?
36.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, yeah, she is a lawyer. So we are the kind of archetypal sensible one and creative one.
Right.
Her being the sensible one, me being the creative one.
Uh-huh.
So yeah. But yeah, she's a hoot.
She's a hoot.
And you know, anytime I need some legal advice, she's always there.
Yeah, that's always nice.
Yeah.
She back in Texas or?
No, she's in Orange County. So she lived up here for a little bit, but moved back there to work for the county. So.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
That's cool. What was it like growing up in your household? I always like to get a read on.
Sure.
Because not super unique, but I had parents that weren't that super into movies and
right.
pop culture. And I mean, it's not like they shunned it,
mm-hmm.
but I definitely didn't have the parents who were like, oh God, you got to watch this
yeah.
or you should listen to this.
Yeah, I did not have that either. My parents were not that you know, they're not hip people.
Right.
You know, we, you know, saw movies at the mall and, you know, watched a lot of network TV, didn't have HBO. To me, growing up, that was the mark of a family who was really cultured.
Wow.
If they had HBO.
But we even had HBO.
Oh, nice. Okay. my mother is a very nice woman. Mm-hmm. She's a nurse. She's been a nurse for her entire life.
Oh, that's great.
Not her entire life, but, you know, sure. In her adulthood.
When she was
she wasn't
age.
A baby nurse, which would be a pretty
I
cute
was about
kid
to
show.
Say, dude, that's a premise.
it's a companion piece to Boss Baby.
Right.
A more working class Boss Baby. Lil Nurse. She does not understand entertainment stuff, has a hard time wrapping her head around it, but has always been very supportive. I have a fucking boring ass childhood where my mom was nice and wanted me to do what I wanted to do. And
oh, the worst.
I know. It sucks. It fucking sucks. I want to come in. I want to come on these and talk about how I, came home with green hair and had to sleep in the treehouse and, you know, smash my guitar against the wall.
Yeah.
But no, they were always really nice, even when I wanted to do kind of dorky stuff, you know, when I wanted to wear a cape to high school for a couple weeks and carry all my books in a bowling bag and do all that dumb.
Did you do that?
Yeah,
bowling
I was. I was a quintessential drama dork.
Uh-huh.
So I discovered, you know, again, what a fucking boring ass backstory I have. So basic.
That's not boring.
It's standard for these kinds of things, I think.
Well, I mean, it makes you stand out a bit in the world of comedians because you're not tortured.
That's true. Yeah.
You know, not most, but.
But yeah, no, I definitely. I mean, I have my ups and my downs, of course, and I struggle with various things. But yeah,
sure.
I definitely don't consider myself a sad clown.
Right.
I'm a content clown who certainly has moments of darkness and self doubt.
Right.
But essentially, is pretty happy to be where he's at.
Yeah. So you're doing drama in high school?
I'm doing drama in high school. So yeah, I discovered drama, and we had a little improv group, which was huge for me, which was like mind blowing.
Yeah,
because I think I was always kind of a goof off type. So I think the idea of being able to like goof off while people watched you, was great.
Yeah, we didn't have anything like that in our school.
Oh yeah,
not improv. I didn't even know that was a thing.
Did you? Was there a drama club in school plays and stuff like that?
Yeah, but I was. I mean, I've never been a performer.
Yeah.
Which is funny now that I, you know, can get on a stage and
right for a shit ton of people.
Yeah, but I've gotten used to that. But I'm still, I don't consider myself a performer and like an actor. I'm terrible at that.
Interesting, but it seems like you know, drama club, you know, draws in the like look at me kids,
sure,
which I was one of.
Uh-huh.
But I think it also draws in general. Kind of, I'm artsy and haven't found my people yet,
yeah.
Kids. I think, you know, like,
outsiders.
Yeah, I think like, you know, drama club, you know, the tech crew is filled with punk kids.
Yeah.
The like orchestra is filled with like band geeks.
Right.
I don't know. It seemed to be this kind of like nerd unifier, or at least it was at my high school.
Uh-huh.
So you have the kind of like, look at me. I know what rent is,
right.
Kids.
Yeah.
But then, you know, the productions kind of pull in all these other kind of, you know, not jock types.
Right.
Anyway.
Other types of John Hughes archetypes.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. other Breakfast Club members all kind of band together.
Were you popular?
That's complicated. So I was homecoming king.
Oh, wow.
I was elected homecoming king, and I found out later, like after I had graduated college, I found out on MySpace, I got in touch with this kid named Justin Reynolds. He was the punk kid who hung the lights.
Right.
So, you know, he always had like a leather jacket and a Vice Squad butt flap.
Right.
So Justin Reynolds was the like crew kid. And I friended him on MySpace.
Uh-huh.
And
is that what you called that back then? Friended?
Yes.
Okay.
Oh yeah. What did you call it?
I don't know. I don't think
was
I had
MySpace. Friending?
Oh,
was, interesting. You
late.
Skipped MySpace.
Yeah.
So anyway,
yeah.
And he sent me a message on the MySpace after I had friended him.
Right.
saying that, hey, remember when you won Homecoming King? I was working in the office and I rigged the ballot so you would win. So I am a false Homecoming King of Capo Valley.
Wow. That's better than I thought. I thought you were going to say, I just had a pit in my stomach. I thought you were going to say that it was like Carrie.
I got carried. Oh, yeah. Yeah,
that it was just a big joke on you.
Boring backstory. You know, Orange County is a pretty conservative place.
Sure.
I think up until very, very recently, actually up until this election, I think it always goes red. It's like
did it swing?
It's like the one little pocket of California that was red until very recently, which is nice. Good on you, Orange County. So it's pretty conservative. You know, there is a like jock culture for sure. Like a lot of surfer guys turned water polo guys.
Oh.
Like those were kind of our jocks.
Okay.
We're kind of a bleached blonde.
Right.
You know, maybe much like some of the characters in today's movie, Point Break.
Yeah.
So that like culture is very prevalent in Orange County. Uh-huh. But I was able to go to high school, sometimes in a cape, sometimes carrying my books in a bowling bag. And I didn't get hassled too much. I mean, I had a little bit of teasing, but I kind of got to just be a little weirdo and experiment. And I'm really like grateful for that because, you know, you hear stories from other creative people about how it was like a struggle and people didn't want them to do that. And everybody wanted them to straighten up and put on a tie and, you know, and stuff like that. But yeah, I was very, very lucky to grow up, you know, being able to like experiment and be a goofball and find myself. So yeah, I'm really, really thankful that that was my upbringing for sure.
Well, I mean, you're funny and that's always a secret weapon, I think.
Yeah.
So even if you are at risk of being bullied, if you're funny, that helps, I think.
Yeah. And I think I can code switch between nerd and bro. Maybe not nerd and jock, but nerd and bro. Yeah,
which is the bridge.
Yes, exactly. So, I mean, I think I can, you know, because, I think I can, I think I kind of learned how to, like, talk to that sort of person and not come off like a, you know, artsy goober.
Right.
And then once I'm away from them, I can turn back into an artsy goober.
I haven't heard goober in a while.
Yeah.
Let's bring that back.
Sure, I know. Hey, I mean, I'm proud. I'm a proud goober. Hey, if you're out there and you're a proud goober, hit me up. Hashtag goob squad. Goob troop.
When did you, were you legit acting and stuff in the plays?
Yeah, and I think that's not necessarily because I was a good actor, but just because I think the drama club needed boys.
Uh-huh.
I think that's the curse of many high school drama departments is they just need boys.
Uh-huh.
So I think I got up on stage pretty regularly. Not because I'm you know, super talented at performing, but because I was just enthusiastic and wanted to be there and would show up and was a boy. So
right. And what about the improv? Was that through the school? Like it was actually
So we did a thing called Comedy Sports with a Z, Comedy Sports with a Z is still active in LA. I think they still have a performance space. I'm not positive, but they have teachers. You know, people who are part of their troupe go to high schools and kind of teach them rudimentary improv games, stuff you would see on Whose Line Is It Anyways.
Right.
A lot of like, you know, all right, like we're going to give you a weird hat and you guys have to make up a scene.
Right.
Stuff like that. And so, these people from Comedy Sports would come, you know, would come to the high school and teach us these games and help us put on these little shows. And we were very thrilled because our coach had played a helicopter pilot on That's My Bush, Central show about George W. Bush.
I don't remember that.
It was something the South Park guys did it.
Oh, really?
And it was like in the –
That's My Bush.
Yeah, yeah. So
that's funny.
Anyway.
So he was on that show though?
Yes, he was.
Nice.
And it was my first time meeting a like professional creative person, which I did not grow up around.
Uh-huh.
I think a lot of people think that, you know, Orange County is close to LA, so you probably knew a lot of show business people. Like I did not. Like I knew the only grown-ups I knew were like real estate people and jet ski salesmen.
Right.
Like that is who lives in Orange County. So like meeting a creative person, a professional creative person was a pretty big deal. Yeah. And then because we met the comedy sports guy, we would like pile in my mom's van and drive up to LA to see improv shows.
Wow.
So yeah, that was kind of like my childhood adventures were like piling in a van and going to see improv shows and punk shows. So that was kind of like my, you know, first little glimpse at the grown-up world.
That's cool, though. I mean, that's great access.
Yeah, it's really nice. It was really nice to have that stuff around.
Yeah, I didn't have a lot of that going on around me. And
Atlanta, that's where you?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and, you know, the suburbs of Atlanta, it was just, I had no idea that you could do this as a job.
Yeah, yeah.
Not podcasting, obviously. That was not a thing in
just
the 80s.
a glimmer in the eye of Silicon Valley.
I didn't know you could do that. I just don't know. I never thought about movies in that way. Like, this is a job you can do.
Right. I always thought I would be a fun drama teacher.
Right.
Which is, I mean, still time for that. I mean, could very well still happen.
And probably, no shame in that either.
Of course not. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, absolutely. Yeah. If you're a fun drama teacher out there, good on you.
Like, for sure.
Giving the artsy goobers of the world a chance to like express themselves. No, that is a very important, noble job for sure.
Yeah. Well, both of my parents were teachers, so I identify with that a bit.
Oh, that's right. Your dad was like your English teacher, right?
My principal.
Your principal.
Yes.
Oh man. That's cool.
Yeah, it was fine.
Yeah.
Elementary school, that is. High school, it probably would have been a little tougher, I think.
Now, I don't know the geography of Georgia that well, but okay. I mean, you know, I think Athens has that like legendary music scene. Did you pile in a station wagon and go see bands in Athens, or was that not possible?
No, I did not.
Okay.
Athens is an hour away. I went to school there.
Oh, yeah?
So when I was 18,
Didn't you rent videos to Michael Stipe or something?
Yeah, he came by the video store.
Cool. That's a feather in your cap.
Yeah. I mean, college was really where I blossomed into like a complete normal human, though.
Sure.
Especially in Athens, you know, plenty of opportunity. But I didn't. I mean, I was going to concerts and stuff from the time I was like 13.
Yeah.
But it was, you know, the big shows at the big arena.
Yeah, yeah.
I was not nearly cool enough to know about like the coolest shit I was listening to was like The Cure and The Smiths and REM and stuff.
Okay. That was pretty cool.
Not on the punk scene though.
Like, sure, yeah.
I was not privy to that.
Though that was kind of like on the radio at that point.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, for sure. But this is about you.
That's true. This is about me. I'm naturally inquisitive. I'm sorry.
When did you start, like, well, tell me about meeting Jesse in college.
Sure,
Because that was a pretty big deal.
So, yeah. So, I mean, I think based, you know, so I kind of, like, had started thinking about, you know, oh, okay, like, yeah, I like TV and I like comedy and that has to get there somehow. Maybe people write it. Where do they, you know? So it was still kind of baffling to me. And so then I went to college at UC Santa Cruz, which is kind of Northern California.
Yeah. What's it like there? Jesse jokes about it so much, but
yeah,
I always wonder what the truth is.
It is a hilarious, ridiculous, beautiful place.
Uh-huh.
Really, really, a really special kind of magical place. It is, you know, it is very, very hippy-dippy. Mm-hmm. It is pretty stuck in the 90s. I went back a couple years ago and, you know, people were still wearing flannel shirts tied around their waists.
Oh, yeah?
And there were still, like, posters for bands on
Sublime.
Telephone poles. Yeah, a little bit. Maybe a little less sublime and a little more I think sublime's not quite right, but I mean, I'm very sensitive to California musical geography.
Yeah, that was more San Diego, I guess.
I think Sublime are famously from Long Beach, but I think definitely probably their core fan base was in San Diego.
Yeah,
yeah, like white stoners, white dreadlocks.
Sure.
Although there were a lot of white dreadlocks at UC Santa Cruz, but I think they probably listened to actual reggae.
Right.
and really let you know about it.
Yeah.
Really let you know that their shit was the real shit, really irae.
Yeah.
It is, you know, it's a little hippie paradise. It's a little, you know, there's a little Berkeley spice in there.
Mm-hmm.
There's a little like Venice Beach you know, peppered in.
Right.
And it's kind of just this little enclave. It is very, very, you know, radically liberal.
Mm-hmm. How big is it?
It is, boy, I don't know. I think it is definitely one of those places where the biggest part of the town is the university.
Uh-huh.
So I think that, like, university students are a pretty big portion of the population.
Right.
So, yeah, but then you had, you know, the locals were a lot of, like, surf burnouts and people who sold candles and, you know, stuff like that. Although I have maybe heard that some of Silicon Valley has started to trickle down there.
It's creeping in.
Yeah.
How far is that from San Francisco?
It's an hour and some change.
Okay.
Yeah.
I guess that's that people will drive that.
Yeah, sure. I think, yeah. And I think maybe if, you know, you are a little bit of a crunchier granola, one of those tech guys, you probably like the salt air and the access to surfing and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So yeah, it was great. I mean, it's a silly place. It, you know, it does definitely is its own little reality. And definitely, you know, they did not provide any kind of resources to have a career in show business.
Mm-hmm.
I think I went into the, you know, career counseling person when I was about to graduate and asked about any, like, internships or, you know, entry level PA type jobs in showbiz. And I think they had one listing for an assistant camera operator for a local news station in San Jose.
Right.
So, you know, and I think, you know, the, like, performance and writing programs were preparing you to be, like, an agitprop street clown.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's probably the, like, the highest calling of the UC Santa Cruz performance graduate.
Right.
Is can you create some sort of challenging street art,
right,
to freak out squares.
Right. Like, you're going to need a trunk that you can fit a lot of props in, but
yeah,
you can also carry it under your arm.
Yes, exactly.
As you're running down the street.
Right, exactly. When the cops are chasing you away for fucking speaking the truth, yeah, and freaking out the... Anyway, so Jesse Thorne, owner and head honch over at Maximum Fun.
Mm-hmm.
So we met. He was my RA.
Wow.
B4 South in the Porter dorms.
Wow.
So I thought he was a cool dude because he, you know, he was a comedy nerd. He had like a Kids in the Hall poster and a Tenacious D poster.
Yeah.
Kind of some of that, you know, fringy comedy stuff that, you know, you always felt like someone was a kindred spirit if they liked.
Yeah, and I remember that dorm thing where the posters were such a signifier.
Totally. Oh,
so,
yeah.
So, like, a lot of thought went into what you put on your wall.
Yeah, it really, like, said a lot about you or what you – yeah, it was like the person you wanted to be, kind of.
Yeah, at least if you feel like I did, which was, like, maybe a little – nervous in your own skin.
Totally.
Like, I wasn't like, yeah, I'm going to put this poster up because it's just fucking what I like. Yeah. I was like, oh, well, if I put up this Jane's Addiction poster,
right,
like, I do love them, but boy, that's cool.
Yeah, exactly. I'm going to pick the things I like the ones I display.
Right.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Maybe keep some of the other stuff quiet. Yeah, so we met and he was on the, like, UC Santa Cruz improv group called Humor Force 5, a bad, embarrassing improv team name if there ever was one.
They're all pretty bad, though.
I know. Yeah. That's always a fun thing to do when you're meeting another, you know, comedy person is ask them the name of their embarrassing college improv group.
Right.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, we were Fart Patrol. Right. Okay, yeah, sure. We were Satellite of Love. Yeah, okay, I know.
Right.
So I started doing the improv group over there, Human Force 5, and then Jesse also was a DJ on the college radio station, KZSC 88.1 FM, the Heavyweight 88. And he had me come in and do little bits on his college radio show, and then I started co-hosting it with him. And yeah, and that was kind of the, you know, that was kind of the zenith, genesis. What word am I looking for? The beginning.
The Zenegis.
Yeah, oh boy, that sounds like a Rush album.
Yeah.
Zenegis. And that was kind of the start of our podcast. So we did that college radio show together.
Yeah. What was the name of it?
It was called The Sound of Young America.
Oh, okay.
Which became his NPR show, which he changed the name of
to Bullseye.
To Bullseye.
I used to love that name. I remember when he changed it. I was like, man, Sound of Young America is so good.
I know. I think it was. I think it was like. It was some record label slogan that might have sued him.
Oh, really?
So yeah, I think it was like the
that makes sense.
Daptone slogan at one point or something like that.
Okay.
Anyway, so we so when he moved to LA, so after college, I moved to LA and started doing like PA jobs, mm-hmm. and he moved here kind of shortly after, and then he's just like, "Do you want to start doing our old college radio show, but on the internet?
Right.
It's called a podcast."
Yeah.
And yeah, so we're still doing it today.
Yeah. How many years now?
I think 12 years.
Yeah, because you guys got in about a year before I did.
Yeah, yeah. So yeah, I mean, I think we, you know, us and you and Jimmy Pardo and
right.
And some of those early Ricky Gervais podcasts.
Yeah,
were kind of some of the
I
first.
Remember those.
To,
Mark
you know,
Maron, of course.
Yeah, Mark Maron. I think Mark Maron was a little bit later.
A little later, but yeah. Didn't like Jesse set him up?
I think so. Yeah, I think that's part of it. Yeah, as he kind of helped him get his gear together.
Yeah.
So yeah, definitely like you know. We were here before all you kids.
I know.
In your serials, in your makings of murderers.
Well, it's funny too.
Maybe that's a Netflix show. I'm sorry, but I mean you like murder on podcasts. You guys sure. like murder.
Yeah, it's lots of murder.
Yes. Anyway,
when Serial hit it big and all the articles started flooding in, like New York Times,
sure.
and New Yorker, about you know this new thing, and I know a lot of us had a sort of a half smirk about it all.
Yeah. Yeah.
But also, like, I was smart enough to know, like, this is great.
Totally. You know? Absolutely.
Like,
yeah.
I can roll my eyes a little bit, but I love Serial.
Yeah, totally. Serial
so
is great. I mean,
for the
I
industry.
Think it is. Yeah, I mean, it was a little silly how it's like, there's this new thing called a podcast,
yeah.
and it's also a Serial.
Right.
You know, I think the like, media was a little dumb with that.
Yeah.
But, yeah, absolutely. No, I think it's been huge for the industry and definitely, yeah. like, so nice that, you know, we can this thing that we do, we can A, keep doing it.
Mm-hmm.
We can put it out every week without it being a financial burden on us.
Right.
And also maybe it could turn into something else. It's great to see podcasters, you know, turning their shows into books and TV shows
right.
and comics and kind of all this other stuff. So it's really great that not only can this be a little job,
uh-huh.
but also it can maybe turn into something else. So that's like awesome. And I think that's, you know, Serial was a big part of that for sure.
Yeah. As someone who has done the same show for a long time mm-hmm. as well, like how do you approach it after 12 years?
Well, I mean, Jordan Jesse Go, the show I do with Jesse, is kind of its own, it's a special case because it is not about anything.
Mm-hmm.
It's just us chatting with a guest each week.
Yeah.
And we have some kind of recurring segments and stuff like that. But it's, you know, for better or for worse, it is the two white guys chatting podcast.
Right.
It's the joke about podcasts.
Yeah.
It's just two white guys, you know.
But it wasn't a joke when you started.
No, of course. And I think, you know, that was its own little genre for a while.
Yeah.
And, you know, but so, you know, I don't think – we have a really great, loyal, nice fan base. They're not – God, it's so nice to do something on the internet
yeah.
for not assholes.
Yeah, same here, man. We've got good folks that
yeah.
listen.
So we have this kind of great little pocket. It's not a giant audience, but mm-hmm. they're strong and they're loyal and they like the show.
Yeah.
So yeah, and you know they donate to Max Fund, so you know we make a little bit of money each month mm-hmm. from their nice donations. And so you know it's not a – you know, it's not a financial suck on us to do the podcast.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, I don't think either of us thinks that, you know, 12 years in, Jordan Jesse Go is going to become, you know, a TV show or something like that. But I think it's fun.
Mm-hmm.
We get to see each other, which is nice.
Yeah.
You know,
is that part of it?
Yeah, kind of. I mean, I think Jesse and I are very different in that he is married with three kids.
Right.
And, you know, doesn't get out to hang a lot.
Yeah.
So I think the kind of the podcast is our hang
mm-hmm.
where we get to kind of catch up and, you know, like other friends too. You know, we, you know, the comics we have on the show or the people we have on our show are usually buds.
Right.
So it's, you know, it's a kind of a fun little chance to catch up and yeah. And, you know, and the audience is kind of nice and they, you know, kind of kindly donate. So it's like, okay, we can still do this and it's worth doing.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think we, you know, we do it because we love it and we do it because our fans are so nice.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think we are looking to take it to any other kind of level.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think Jordan Jesse Go is just kind of a nice part of my life that has always been, that will always just be a pleasure. Like it's not.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's rarely stressful and it's rarely, you know, work. Anything. But yeah, yeah, it says it definitely does not feel like work.
Yeah. So is it the kind of thing you want to do forever?
I think so. I mean, I can't think of a reason that we would stop doing Jordan Jesse Go. I mean, Maybe there would be some sort of like hiatus if, you know, I don't know, if there was family stuff or if I, you know, who knows? Maybe one of us would get a job in, you know, New York or something and would have to put it on hold for a while. But yeah, I mean, I think it's something we want to do for the, you know, for the foreseeable future. I don't think there's any reason to.
That's cool.
Yeah.
My wife, it's funny, about 2 months ago, she heard a snippet of your theme song by The Free Design.
Yes.
On maybe a TV show.
Yeah, there was an Amazon show. It was the Fred Armisen, Maya Rudolph Amazon show.
That's
used a little
totally
bit.
It.
Yes.
We watched
got a lot
that.
Of tweets because of that.
Yeah, and she freaked out because she was just like, I know that song. I know that song.
Yeah, yeah.
And she doesn't listen to podcasts. So I was like, well, I know you don't know it from that.
Right.
And I was like, wait a minute. I know that song. I figured out very quickly that was JJ Go.
Yeah.
But she did a deep dive on the internet and realized it was a song that her babysitter sang for her.
Really?
When she would go to sleep when she was a little kid.
It does have lullaby-ish qualities,
it
for
does.
Sure.
So she like had this big moment of like all this flood of memories coming back with this song. Hadn't heard it since she was like 4.
Yeah.
And heard it again and was like, oh my God. And I was like, yeah, that's Jordan Jesse Go's theme song. She was like, really?
That's funny.
And learned all the words and now sings it to my daughter in bed every night.
Oh, that's really cute.
And I do a little background like bum, bum, bum. And
oh, that's great.
I can't commit the words to memory because I'm terrible like that.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's kind of become a fun little thing. And like now every night when I put my daughter to bed, like weirdly – in the back of my brain, I'm thinking of you guys.
That's funny. So yeah, I mean, you should just complete the experience after you sing the song to your daughter. Just
put
make
on the
a
podcast.
Bunch of. Well, I was gonna say make a bunch of dick jokes and remember old Sega Genesis games,
right,
which is the bulk of the podcast.
Pretty much
talking about our balls, remembering Sega Genesis.
Let's talk about Bubble before we get on Point Break, though.
Yes,
That is the scripted comedy show that you put out last year with Max Fun.
Yeah.
And how did that come about? Was that your baby?
Yeah. So, I mean, I for years worked on the TV show At Midnight.
That's right.
On Comedy Central.
How was that? You had a good time doing that.
Yeah,
right?
That was a blast.
Yeah.
That was a really fun writer's room. And, you know, just like the guests that they brought in through that place were amazing. So it was like, you know, getting a cool new coworker every day.
Yeah, and kind of your first big professional writing gig, wasn't it, or was it?
Yeah, I mean, I had had a lot of other jobs in like Deep Cable and like
Deep Cable.
I was on. I did a lot of writing for Channel 612. So a lot of like real obscure cable stuff and like internet stuff.
Yeah.
But At Midnight was my first WGA job, certainly.
Wow.
And yeah, definitely my first, you know, thing that was kind of high profile, more than people who watch Channel 612 had heard about.
Yeah.
So kind of that show was kind of approaching the end, and I think we all kind of knew it was the end.
Yeah.
And, you know, everybody kind of started getting their writing samples in order to go out and look for jobs.
Get those packets ready.
Got to get those packets ready. So I kind of was thinking about the kind of thing I wanted to do after At Midnight.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I mean, I think I was like, okay, well, boy, late night is sure a lot of Trump, you know. So I guess, you know, the idea of doing more kind of news jokes seemed a little exhausting to me. But I'm like, okay, well, what do I like? I like sci-fi, I like genre stuff. I like, you know, I love it when that stuff has a sense of humor. Like, you know, so maybe I'll try and write a funny sci-fi thing. So I kind of had this vague idea of a, you know, of a hipster city that was kind of like a Silver Lake or a Portland or a Brooklyn that, you know, that was really great and had all this cool coffee and all these bike lanes and dog parks.
Right.
But also it had these space monsters that killed you when you went for your morning jog.
Yeah.
You know, and I think it's part of, you know, just kind of the joke of that being that, like, you know, to live in one of these cool places is very nice, but it's also hard. Like, it's expensive and, you know, cities can be nightmarish. And,
yeah.
You know, and now that people are you know, relying on the gig economy more. It's like, how do you make your rent in one of these places?
Right.
So, you know, kind of taking the struggle of that and, you know, and just adding a sci-fi element to it.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, so I kind of had this idea of a, you know, a hipster city where you had to fight monsters and kind of, you know, kind of slowly just kind of in my notes app kind of jotted down little ideas for characters or what the world would be like or the backstory. And yeah, and then just kind of like sat down to write it one day. And,
were you thinking TV?
I was thinking TV, yeah. And I didn't necessarily think it was something people would make because it's crazy.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I thought this could be a good sample.
Yeah.
Like this is a good sample to, you know, right. that would get people from, you know, The Flash or whatever to interview me. So, you know, I wrote the sample and we did a little staged reading of it here at a little comedy theater and, you know, just recorded that and put out the audio. And I'm like, okay, well, that's something I've kind of got on other people with writing samples is that I know podcast people. So I can make a little podcast like thing out of this.
Right.
And, you know, and that'll set it apart from the other fucking pile of scripts people get every day. So we made that, and then I had a couple of meetings about Bubble, and you know, kind of the tone of them all was like, this is cool. We like this. We will never make this.
Yeah.
You know? There was a lot of like that, and it was kind of frustrating, and I'm like, boy, I mean, a lot of people seem to be responding to this thing, but nobody wants to do anything with it. You know, that's the weird disconnect. So then I think Jesse and Max Fun were thinking about trying something scripted. You know, so I think that was kind of a natural choice for them because it already had a little fan base from the staged reading. So I think then you know, they just kind of invested some money into hiring editors, writers, actors, and kind of, tried to do it as legit as possible. Tried to make it as TV-like an experience as possible. And then we did 8 episodes, soon to be 9 episodes. And it really took off in a way that was surprising and delightful.
Yeah, I think you guys, you're a groundbreaker, and I don't think you know that.
Like, sure.
You know, with Jordan Jesse Go starting out years ago and then with Bubble, it's got to be probably the biggest scripted comedy show that's been out, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's a lot of other really great scripted genre things out there. Welcome to Night Vale comes to mind. The Bright Sessions is another great one.
Oh, yeah. I've heard of that.
And they've all kind of been doing this sort of thing for a while with great success, and you know they all have a lot of fans. I think Bubble was notable just because it was such a production.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it you know, we didn't want it to be like found audio,
right?
Which I think a lot of things mostly for production reasons are all kind of
it's
like
tricky.
This is found audio.
Which is
a very cool way to do it, but I think, you know, I just kind of felt like that had been done. So I think Bubble was just notable because it is a TV like product for your ears.
Yeah.
And it had a, you know, continuity and, you know, it had an arc and stuff like that. So yeah, I think it was cool. I think we were definitely trying to do something new-ish.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we did. I think it's pretty, you know.
Oh, that's great.
It definitely is. I think it does feel unique in the world of scripted podcasts.
Yeah, and I think the timing of it too was pretty great. Like 5 years ago, it may not have registered like it did now.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think, you know, podcasts have been going on for long enough, and you know, and I think there's a certain. I mean, I'm sure you encounter this when you're, you know, sitting next to some strangers at a wedding trying to explain what a podcast is.
Yeah,
and I think that now people have caught on to the, you know, to the technology, and they are willing to try some stuff that is a little more out there artistically, which is great. So I think that, you know, there are enough chat podcasts and there are enough news podcasts. Mm-hmm. I think people –
plenty of true crime.
There's plenty of true crime. If you want to – yes, if you want to hear about a murder, there are now podcasts devoted exclusively to eye trauma.
Yeah.
Any kind of murder you like, you can get a boutique podcast eye just trauma. For – yeah, right. Do you like choking? Right. There's a whole choking section of iTunes, of Apple Podcasts. Just type in murder.choking and you can get... I don't know. I think people are just like, cool, I got this. Podcasts are part of my life. Mm-hmm. They're part of my commute. They're part of my media intake. Let's try something new.
Yeah, that's cool. I think we're all interested to see where that goes.
Yeah, definitely. And it's definitely nice, you know, I think, you know, being in a town that is full of people who have scripts that they love who that don't go anywhere. Mm-hmm. It's nice that there's options. You can do podcasts or comics or web series or so it is cool that some of these great ideas that are great, but you know, TV can still be very conservative. Not politically necessarily, but just like
taking chances on
creatively.
Things.
Yeah. Totally. So it's nice that, you know, just feeling like just because something is too out there for NBC,
right,
that it would never find an audience.
Yeah. I mean, it's a cool time to be a creator and a writer, I think, because gone are the days where you're just sort of sitting around waiting for your phone to ring.
Yeah.
You can be much more like proactive.
Totally.
And how you get your stuff out there.
Yeah, exactly. It is really nice to live in a world where you don't have to like rely on other – you don't have to get permission to work.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, like if you want to do this, you can do it.
Uh-huh.
You know, and it – you know, obviously we all would like to make some money.
Sure.
And we'd all like to be paid and have health insurance and stuff. But as far as the creative part of it, it's like you can create your thing and you can – have people who like your thing.
Yeah.
And hopefully the money and the health insurance comes later.
Right.
But it's nice to know that it's nice to know that you can do that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's great. Shall we?
Let's shall.
With Point Break.
Oh, I would love to.
All right. This movie came out when I was the summer before my sophomore year in college.
Mm-hmm.
And for some reason that summer, me and my two friends, Chris and Jerry, saw a bunch of movies together. I think we're just in the same town and bored.
Mm-hmm.
And Point Break was one of like the big ones that year for us.
Okay.
That I have like very distinct memories of going to see this. And I even remember it rained very, very hard after we saw it. And my friend,
you were getting out of the movie and you're like, it's the 50 year storm. We're in it.
Dude, that was it. And we were in my friend's Jeep who had the top down. It wasn't raining when we went in.
Yeah.
And I remember this great drive and the pouring rain with the, you know, and we were making all the jokes about Point Break and the 50 year storm. And it's just one of those movies that really like the actual viewing of the movie still stands out to me.
That's awesome.
All these years later.
Yeah. I mean, it's a great movie to see with like a big group. It is a movie about groups and tribes and kind of made families. So it's nice. It's nice to see that with your kind of like friend family.
Yeah. What was your deal? And I mean, you probably saw this on VHS later, right?
Yes. So this was, I don't specifically remember the first time I saw this, but I remember it being a sleepover movie, like a movie that people had on VHS and maybe kind of later DVD. And it would be something you would put on at a sleepover and kind of watch the first couple minutes and then, you know, just sleepover shit would start.
Sure.
You know, you'll start talking and fucking with each other and, you know, sleepover shit.
Yeah.
So, you know, it was a movie that I had seen but, like, had not – like, I had fond memories of. And I've, obviously everything stopped. All the sleepover shit stopped when – Lori Petty was towel changing by her car. And so, you know, there was kind of like parts that we loved, but it was something that I had fond memories of, but rarely sat down to watch the whole thing.
Yeah.
You know, and of course you knew the lines. You knew Vaya con Dios. You knew, are you going to jump or jerk off?
Yeah.
I'm young, dumb, and full of cum.
Oh, man.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many lines in this. So, yeah, it was kind of a movie that existed in little chunks.
Mm-hmm.
And then I remember, like, in college actually sitting down and, like, watching it in a dark room and paying attention and going like, this is kind of a great movie.
Yeah.
Like, this is kind of a, foo boy, I might get some shit for this. This is a Die Hard caliber action movie that is cool and thoughtful and very funny.
It is very funny. Like, watching it, it's, I mean, it's corny as hell.
Yes.
But, like, That's because that's the kind of movies that they were making then.
Yeah.
Like the DNA of Kathryn Bigelow's career
right.
was all there. But she just wasn't allowed to make movies like The Hurt Locker.
Totally.
At that point.
Yeah. And it does feel like this movie is a commentary and maybe even a little bit of a satire on those kinds of movies. It's definitely a turned up to 11 version of those, you know, Van Damme, Steven Seagal, you know, Bruce Willis, Sylvester Stallone movies. You know?
And it does feel like the tongue is in cheek.
Yeah. It does
unless I'm just totally making that up.
I don't think so. And I think that's a big question about Point Break is how much of it is funny on purpose.
Right.
And it's a fun thing to kind of puzzle out. And
I do
genuinely think that the crazy stuff they know is crazy and they're doing it for fun.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that, you know, a great example of that is there's this awesome foot chase where Keanu Reeves is chasing
one of the best foot chases.
It's so rad. Yeah, and these are really well put together. And sometimes when you go back and watch all these action movies, the action doesn't hold up just because action has changed so much.
Yeah.
It's like how do you watch Kickboxer in a world where you've also seen The Raid?
Right.
It's like it just looks so fucking lame.
Yeah, yeah.
But this movie is done by a pretty brilliant filmmaker. And so the action is really terrific.
Totally holds up.
But there's this moment in that foot chase.
I know what you're going to say.
Yes, sure. I mean, it's iconic. It's iconic. It is Bruce Willis walking over the glass. Uh-huh. It is Patrick Swayze throws a dog at Keanu Reeves.
He throws a pit bull at him.
Keanu Reeves catches it and then punts it like a football. They know that's funny. They know that. Oh, and it's so funny. As I watched it for this, I let the credits play because I was enjoying the rat song. Yeah. Oh God, what is that song called?
Oh, I don't know.
Nobody Rides for Free.
Oh yeah, yeah.
So I was enjoying the music and I just kind of noticed the you know the part where it says animals were not harmed in the making of this.
Uh-huh.
So I had never seen this before. In the credits it says, there is a scene of an animal being harmed. But a decoy of the animal was used.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Obviously
that's a pretty good credit find.
Was punting a false dog. Another great Rush album.
Yeah.
Punting a false dog.
You're going to have to come up with one more, you know.
Shit. Fuck. Okay, I will.
Rule of threes.
Oh, yeah. I know. I'm a comedy professional. I know rule of threes.
Yeah. That was for the listener.
So, yeah. But I do think there are moments like that. You know, kind of let you know that they get how crazy some of this stuff is.
I think so. There's no way you can throw a pit bull at a guy in a fight because that means, if you think about what's going on, he would have had to have if you're Swayze,
yes,
you would have had to run out of the front of that house with him right behind you, see this pit bull,
yeah,
and decide, I'm going to pick this dog up and wait until he gets here and then throw it at him. It's so great.
It is awesome.
I had forgotten about that moment. And it's one of the great, great moments.
Yeah. And it is in the middle of a really well put together, cool chase.
Yeah.
So it's like you have this like cool filmmaking on display just with these, I don't know, with these crazy moments that are kind of jokes.
Yeah.
And there's so much impossible stuff in this movie.
Oh yeah.
You know, that is played really seriously.
Uh-huh.
So.
Yeah. The jumping back to the beginning, that first bit of exposition from John C. McGinley is really like something else.
He's so good in this.
Like, you know, the whole deal of like writing those exposition scenes at the beginning to like set everything up. And
there are
so many clever ways of doing that where it doesn't appear like you're doing exposition. And they just flat out, like he's walking down in the hall and he's like, so you're Johnny Utah, first day on the job. First day in the new city.
Yeah.
And like, he literally is like,
LA, bank robbery, capital of the world.
Yeah, and he just lays it all out there in like 30 seconds. It's so great.
Yeah. I know. And exactly. And then, you know, he makes this like joke about Keanu's diet. He's like, oh, you got it. You know, my guys don't drink. They don't. And they sure as hell don't smoke.
Yeah.
And Keanu's like, I take the skin off chicken, sir. Yeah. And then later, like in the middle of that conversation, Keanu picks up a donut. And he's eating the donut.
Oh, I didn't notice that.
Yeah, and then John C. McGinley says, like, you know, he says something about, like, what a dick he is. And he's like, It's like, did they call you because we had an asshole shortage?
Right. There are a lot of great lines like that.
Yeah, I know. And I think he is definitely a heightened kind of comic version of the like hard ass police chief.
Yeah.
You know, I think they definitely – he's kind of a sketch comedy version of that archetype.
Well, and it's full of good actors. I mean, this could have been this could have been a different movie if it would have been Van Damme surrounded by nameless hacks.
Sure.
But like – yeah, John C. McGinley in a very small role. He's a great actor.
Totally.
And kind of across the board, I mean, Keanu Reeves is Keanu Reeves.
He's Keanu-ing. He's Keanu-ing hard in this.
Yeah, I used to make fun of him, and then I had a friend who worked with him, and he said, A, the nicest dude you'd ever meet. And he said, B, he beats himself up so much about the job that he's doing.
Really?
And I instantly, like, felt bad. Mm-hmm. As a person, for making fun of his acting.
I know. I mean, I think
he's really trying.
I think he is trying, and I think he's doing. And again, it's like how much of Keanu is on purpose.
Yeah,
I think a lot of it. I mean, like if you look at like Bill and Ted, like he's this crazy version of a Valley Stoner guy.
Yeah,
and then kind of like walked that back for subsequent movies.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I do think he knows what a Keanu is supposed to do,
and I think he's gotten better over the years as an actor.
Yeah.
It's that tone, that voice of his.
Yeah.
It's sort of hard to leap past that.
Right.
Sometimes because he does sound like Ted or Bill. Wait, shit.
Ted, yeah.
Okay, I'm going to get
Ted. Theodore Logan.
That's right. I forget sometimes.
Yeah.
But yeah, he's a good actor though, I think.
He is, yeah. And he's been great in stuff since then, and he definitely like...
Yeah.
He definitely like kind of plays with his persona in fun ways, I think.
So the ex-presidents, I think, is a brilliant sort of conceit.
It's awesome.
For bank robbers.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you get that moment with, like, Ronald Reagan in his tuxedo.
Yeah.
Spraying this gas torch.
Is there a cooler shot in action movies?
Yeah.
And I guess I don't know enough about, like, Reagan's presidency to, like, unpack the symbolism of that.
Oh, sure, like OPEC and the oil.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I don't know how much political commentary is in that image, but it's so powerful. Just like a guy in a Reagan mask, you know, launching fire all over this gas station. It's really beautiful too. Anyway, so yeah, definitely one of my great bad guys.
And then Busey, you know,
having recently won an Oscar.
What?
Yeah, didn't he win for the Buddy Holly movie?
Oh, recently then.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yes. No, not now. Yeah, he won.
I thought you were talking about now. I was like, dude, I don't think it's been a minute since he's. Okay, so he was coming off of an Oscar win in 91 then.
I think so.
Or close to it,
at least. Yeah, I think so.
For the Buddy Holly movie.
Definitely like, I mean, you know, this is a kind of a harbinger of things to come for Busey.
Yes.
His kind of kooky, out there, madman role.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, maybe this is the first time he kind of played this way.
Yeah, I like that scene where there's just so many ridiculous things in it. It's great. Like, they're in the office after that scene over Mulholland Drive, which is great.
Oh, yeah.
And Keanu Reeves is like, drinking a beer, and you're like, okay, he's drinking a beer, and then Gary Busey takes a whole
bottle of Jack Daniels. It kind of comes from off screen too.
I know.
Yeah, it's just kind
it's
of like
they're working, and he's just drinking whiskey out of the bottle.
Sure, it is. Yeah, it's hilarious. I feel like they definitely let him run wild in this. There's definitely a lot of like little Buseyisms. I think there's this point where he's like pointing a gun at this thug, and he's like, speaking to the microphone, squid for brains.
Yeah.
It's like, that could not have been in the script.
And Lori Petty, like you mentioned, the clothes changing scene. Like,
sure. Yeah.
She was, if you were a kid back then, like Lori Petty was super cool.
Yeah.
And like pretty, but like not like this. She seems somewhat attainable in the way she carried herself on screen.
Yeah, I mean, I think looking back, like, you know, all of these action movies had pretty flimsy female characters.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, in a lot of ways she is kind of underwritten and, you know, kind of there as a, you know, as kind of a plot convenience. She gets kidnapped, has to get saved.
Yeah.
But like, you know, but for the time, I do think she was a really like a pretty like amazing, you know, female character that I think these mm-hmm. types of movies did not have. I mean, she, yeah, I mean, I do love how much shit she gives Keanu when he wants her to teach him how to surf. Mm-hmm. There's this great part where she kind of saves him. She pulls him out of the water when he's trying to surf on his own. And as she's kind of running off, he's like, "My name is Johnny Utah." And you just hear her off screen go, "Who cares?"
Yeah.
And I think the movie was called Johnny Utah at first.
Yeah, that's true.
So I think they, I don't know, I think that was a joke on the fact that that was supposed to be the title of the movie. And
right.
She could not give less of a fuck about him.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and anyway, she's great. And I love how she's, you know, she's the most competent surfer. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in that scene where they're all playing, like, touch football, she's the one who scores the touchdown.
Right.
So, yeah, they really, like, you know, they really try to round her out in ways that maybe she would not have been if the movie was made by a man.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, I mean, and again, with that said, I think she's still, you know, a little bit flimsy, and I think you would, you know, you would not make a movie with a underdeveloped female character like that now. But I mean, I think for the time she was
1991.
So yeah, I mean, yeah. And obviously, like, you know, definitely, like, if you were a, you know, if you were a little punk kid, and yeah. she was the as babe a babe as you could get.
Yeah, yeah.
So
Lori Petty gave many special feelings.
Sure,
to
yeah.
me, even as a sophomore in college.
And then, you know, then League of Their Own.
Yeah,
that's another. Anyway.
Yeah, she's. I looked her up too. Actually, she's still around.
Yeah, still doing it out
yeah,
there,
still
grinding.
Doing her thing. I imagine she still gets tired of being called Billie Jean on the streets.
No, sure.
I bet you she got that a lot.
Yeah.
Who was that actress? Helen something?
Oh, yeah.
Legend of Billie Jean?
I know who you mean.
I even thought it was Lori Petty, and I was like, no, of course it's not.
Yeah.
During the surfing school scene, I'm going to point out some of the cornball things along the way.
Please.
Because it's just so
oh,
great.
Oh, yeah, I know.
But during the scene where she's teaching him to surf, I don't know if you noticed the lyrics of the song.
No, I don't think I did.
I Will Not Fall. It is like
a little on the nose.
So on the nose. It's great.
Yeah.
It's really wonderful, though.
And then I'm Learning to Surf.
Right. Yeah, that's the next song that comes on. But then she tells him about Bodhi, and this is one of the great lines of the movie. Bodhi, they call him Bodhisattva. He's a modern savage, a real searcher.
Yeah.
It's so great. But it sets up that character, you know.
It sure does, yeah. And he is a really great character, a really, like, great, complicated, weird villain.
Yeah.
And, yeah, that is a kind of a funny, clumsy intro to him, for sure.
Modern savage.
He's a modern savage.
Can you imagine what that looked like on the page?
Oh, know, yeah.
To Lori Petty?
She's like, yeah.
But Swayze's great. I mean,
he's awesome.
I'm not ashamed to stick up for Roadhouse.
Fuck, man. Yeah, Roadhouse rules.
Yeah, it's like one of the great movies, I mm-hmm. think, of the time. And you know, we're talking about fun movies, obviously not Oscar winners.
Sure, yeah.
But Roadhouse was great. And, yeah. you know, Dirty Dancing I saw enough to appreciate.
Mm-hmm.
And he was just sort of like, in this movie, to see him, we saw him like we had never seen him.
Mm-hmm.
With that sort of blonde hair. And, you know, all tanned up and stuff.
Yeah.
And it was like the coolest Swayze I had seen, I think.
I know. And the movie definitely ogles him.
Yeah.
You know, definitely in a, you know, if we definitely ogle Lori Petty a little bit when she's changing clothes, it uh-huh. definitely, like, really let you drink Swayze in
yeah.
for a lot of this.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, which I think is kind of cool that he's objectified that much.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, just a great character. And I love how spiritual he is compared to the rest of the doofuses in the gang.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Because yeah.
he talks a lot about it, and it's even, like, bullshit in a way, because he talks about, like, how much he hates violence,
mm-hmm.
like, in the midst of committing tons
yeah.
of acts of violence.
Yeah, I mean, they really, like, they do make a meal out of the moment in the foiled bank robbery where he has to shoot the undercover cop.
Sure.
Like, they definitely linger on that as
yeah.
being, you know, and you can kind of see his eyes through the mask.
Yeah.
You can see his eyes, you know. You know, you could see him realizing that he's turned a corner.
Yeah.
That, like, shit's falling apart. It's a really cool little moment, for sure.
Yeah, I think it works.
Yeah. And I mean, obviously, like, yeah, there is a, you know, there is a disconnect about what a peaceful, chill dude he is and how much shit he kicks
yeah,
throughout
the
movie.
During that one great scene, he talks about the purpose of the whole thing is, like, He's like, it's not about money, man.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's people in their fucking coffins on the freeway.
Metal coffins.
They're metal coffins.
So they are. He's literally saying that they are keeping the human spirit alive,
right,
by robbing banks
and
creating like violent mayhem.
Sure.
Like showing all these people, like, the human spirit is still alive, everybody.
I know. I think that
– very flimsy.
Yes. That point could have been better illustrated. It would have been nice to see, I don't know, like, oh, people are dressing up like the ex-presidents. And,
right.
You know.
It wasn't a flash mob, though.
No. It does seem like you're just robbing banks in masks. Although maybe that's, you know, maybe that's part of the – maybe that was just what they were telling themselves.
Yeah, right.
They were like, oh, this is inspiring people.
We get Anthony Kiedis.
Anthony Kiedis in a little cameo.
Yeah.
Is one of the – there's like – yeah, they're the – yeah, it's like Swayze and his gang are the good thugs. And
right.
then we have this group of bad thugs.
Man, those guys. Like, yeah. They were legit scary. I remember like when I first saw that movie being –
totally.
Pretty freaked out.
Yeah, those are some like severe looking surfer burnouts.
Yeah.
Well cast. Everybody there is really well cast, I think.
Yeah, and the raid scene on their house was really great.
Yeah, that's an awesome scene. Yeah, a lot of funny little like visual jokes in that.
Right.
It is funny how, you know, there's, you know, this kind of movie of the time always had a moment where there was just a nude woman.
Uh-huh.
I think that's part of, as a teenager, why we liked them so much.
Sure. They would find any reason to have just nakedness.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I think there's in Commando, there's this shot where Arnold is fighting someone at a motel, and he throws someone through the door, and there's just a nude woman in the hotel being nude.
Sure.
So this raid scene has a woman who is just in the shower,
uh-huh.
but she beats up like three people,
yeah.
like stabs a guy in the back. So I like
that
they're
the biggest badass in that scene, actually.
Yeah, I like that they are, you know, and again, I think it's part of, you know, part of the argument for this movie being a kind of commentary on these kinds of movies,
uh-huh.
in that the gratuitous nude woman actually hurts a bunch of people and is.
She kicks Keanu's ass.
Yeah, and she doesn't just. You know, I mean, obviously we're trying to intellectualize a moment
right.
of TNA, which is, you know, there's some intellectual gymnastics going on here. But I do think that was a conscious decision. And
yeah.
I do think it is them saying that, you know, can we give a little more agency to these.
Right.
To these nude women.
Yeah. I mean, she does. She kicks more ass in that scene
than anyone
else
does. Yeah, she just randomly grabs a knife and stabs somebody.
Yeah.
So, yeah. But, yeah, very cool scene. I love it when Anthony Kiedis accidentally shoots himself in the foot.
Oh, so great.
Yeah.
Yeah, that one really stood out to me as something that, like, stuck with me.
And I also love in these scenes, in these kinds of, like, movies when just random dirtbags have crazy automatic weapons.
Yeah.
Their weapons arsenal is insane. It's
yeah,
like these
yeah.
guys are drug dealers, but they seem to have grenade launchers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, they do. That guy, that one dude had that, whatever that was, that weird Tommy gun shotgun.
Yeah.
Like hybrid or whatever the hell that was.
I know. It's like, how do these guys get, I mean, I don't know. Maybe it's a,
yeah.
maybe that's a commentary on gun culture. I don't know. But.
Well, I had friends too, like this. So I was a sophomore in college and my best friend from high school was one of these suburban, inland suburban kids who was still way into like the skater and surf culture.
Mm.
So he went to college in Florida so he could surf. And I went down there a couple of times and like I knew these dudes.
Yeah.
Like this, every one of the ex-presidents I felt like I met at Flagler College.
Yeah.
And I knew those surf, and of course, I'm sure you did growing up.
Totally, yeah.
Like, these were real people. They didn't seem like they were, like, 40 years old like these guys did.
Yeah.
But it was a culture that...
Yeah, there's a guy in this who's like, I'm going to die before I'm 30. I'm
yeah.
like, you were 35 years ago. Got to go back in time and commit suicide if that's going to happen.
I remember that part.
Yeah, I'm going to die before I'm 30, man. Okay.
But I kind of knew, like, who these guys were.
Totally.
And the whole, like, violent surf culture is, like, a real thing.
Yeah, I mean, I think there, you know, you do hear. It's funny, there's that documentary about Venice skateboard culture, Dogtown and Z-Boys.
Yeah, yeah, I remember, sure.
And, you know, it really, like, romanticizes that kind of late 70s skate culture. And, you know, I guess the idea is that it started with surfing. You know, it started with surfing, and then, you know, when they couldn't go out in the water because it was too polluted or whatever, they would skateboard.
Mm-hmm.
So it starts out with all these like 70s skaters talking about their time as surfers. And they're like, And, you know, and this is supposed to be a fun part of the movie.
Yeah.
There's this part where one of the guys, like, you know, Tony Alva or something like that, goes, it's like, yeah, you know, we were pretty protective of our breaks. It was locals only. So yeah. If we saw a guy out in the water we didn't recognize, we would stand up on the pier and drop a cinder block on him. And I'm like, what? That's not fun. You are probably a murderer.
Right.
That would kill someone. And he's talking about it like childhood antics.
I know.
Ha ha ha. We would drop cinder blocks on people from piers if we didn't recognize them. It's like that's supposed to be a fun culture, but like, yeah, you guys were kind of psychos, you know, and maybe, you know, maybe people's brains were kind of fried from drugs.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think that world of extreme sports definitely has like a little dark side that I think this thing played with in a fun way.
Yeah. And like, I'm glad that they made sense out of what they were doing, because when you're first seeing that movie, well, when you're first seeing it, when you're 20 or whatever, you just believe whatever. But
sure.
When I was watching it yesterday, I'd kind of forgotten the detail that they were running meth.
Yeah.
And I was like, why do these guys have all these guns and what's going on?
Right.
And, but they were truly bad dudes.
Of course.
Like running drugs and what's his name? Tom Sizemore?
Oh, yeah.
He was the guy.
Oh, yeah.
That got all pissed off.
Sure.
It's kind of an early Sizemore appearance.
Again, this movie filled with better actors than it needs.
Yeah, much better actors than it needs. I have a note here that just says, I'm fucking surfing. It's during the midnight surf.
Yeah.
Like Keanu actually yells
right,
that out.
Right. He's like, when this becomes, yeah, I mean, I think that's the day, or that's the night, rather, when it goes from being an undercover job to like, I'm in too deep.
Yeah.
Like, I love these guys.
Yeah.
It's when he and Lori Petty have sex on the beach.
Right.
They kiss out in the water on their boards.
Yeah, that was a
beautiful
pretty,
moment.
Pretty great.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that's the, you know, that's kind of the turning point for him.
Yeah.
Oh, just one more quick note before we move on from the meth house.
Uh-huh.
It starts with people are staking them out, and you see one of the meth guys pouring beer on cereal.
Yeah.
Anyway.
That's so funny.
It's great. Great little visual joke.
Well, and that's like, this does have James Cameron's fingerprints on it.
Sure.
For better or for worse.
Yeah, I think you know, at least according to IMDb trivia, he and Catherine Bigelow kind of rewrote an existing script.
Yeah.
That there was.
Because they were dating, right?
I think they were married at this point.
Okay.
I don't know for certain, but I think they were married at this point. Yeah, so I think they rewrote it together. And yeah, there's definitely some Cameron shit in this.
Yeah.
There's definitely, I mean, yeah, definitely some of the, you know, some of the more awkward dialogue I would go ahead and probably attribute to him.
Yeah.
You know, man has made some amazing films.
Yeah, where do you stand on him?
Boy, I mean, you know, Cameron movies are always, they're always a blast and they always look cool.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, definitely the man is not a master of dialogue, or maybe he's doing it on purpose. Maybe he's trying to make things more like a fairy tale or simplistic or something like that. But mm-hmm. I would think that I always like them. But they always have some like kind of cornball eye roll stuff that you got to get past to enjoy the spectacle.
No, I agree. His writing is not his strong suit.
No, let somebody else write him, Cameron.
Yeah, exactly. I'm sure he's going to.
You don't got to write him.
The bank stakeout scene kills me because they're staking out this bank.
Yeah,
and just they're the worst stakeout guys ever.
Yeah,
he's like, go get me a sandwich.
Yeah.
And it's all happening behind him.
Utah, give me two.
He's reading the comics.
Yeah, he's reading. Yeah.
They're literally in there robbing the bank.
Busey is like laughing at Calvin and Hobbes in the newspaper.
Great.
And he makes Keanu go get him meatball sandwiches.
Yeah, two meatball sandwiches.
Yeah.
And the whole thing is going on right behind them.
I know.
And then he gets back and he's like, hey, you know, that Continental, how long's that been there? It's like, what Continental?
That's
right. What are you doing?
I know. Yeah, they're such boobs.
It was a good scene, though. The bank robbery scene.
Yeah, it's neat.
Is pretty cool. And, like, I think listen, it is what it is. It's Point Break. But there really is something going on with the last half hour of that film where Keanu, like, the coolest thing that happened in the movie, I think, is when after that he was outed, after the big foot chase with Swayze and the gang show up at his house.
Yeah.
And are just like, what's up, man?
I know, yeah.
Why's your face cut?
Yeah.
Like, that really ramps up the tension.
Totally. I mean, it definitely shows, you know, it definitely, like, is a good example of these guys, you know, this gang will just take that adrenaline rush wherever they can get it. It's like how they live their lives. I mean, they are kind of junkies. It's like at that point they could leave town. They successfully robbed the bank, but they like go to fucking taunt Keanu, you know? It's like, yeah, it's like, wow, these guys, you know, these guys are just, you know, living on the edge at all times.
Yeah.
Yeah, that is a neat moment. The like, who's going to say we know first?
Right.
You know?
Yeah. Someone's going to blink.
Right.
And that sequence is good. The skydiving sequence.
Yeah, the skydiving is awesome.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun.
Yeah. I think Scorsese did his own skydiving.
He did.
Yeah.
He got into it.
Definitely.
You can tell when you're watching it.
Yeah, you can see some of those dirty dancing moves.
Yeah.
That, like, he's a trained dancer. He does have, like, beautiful, like, he just arches back in beautiful ways.
Nice aerial moves.
Yeah. He's so, yeah, he's so graceful. He's, yeah, he's a really, really beautiful performer, even when skydiving. Yeah, definitely that, like, who packed my chute moment is really cool. It's really a cool moment of tension.
Totally.
Yeah, and, yeah, there's definitely a lot of skydiving in this movie.
Yeah, but then they like ramp it up even further by like forcing him to take part. I thought this movie got really good in that third act.
Yeah.
Like it was fun, but that third act was some legit poker playing and, and chess matching, I think, to like force him to go and rob the bank. They have Lori Petty with the one metalhead who all he does is like spit and kick the
fire. I think his name is Rosie.
Rosie.
Yeah.
But that was a good move. Like all of a sudden, Keanu was part of the gang.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Yeah, I really like that part of like you kind of see Keanu enjoying this stuff. You know, he had he had led this kind of button up life. They talk about him going to Quantico.
Right.
Yeah, you kind of like see him enjoy robbing the bank. And there's this moment of like, and it's like it's Swayze trying to convince him that this is the way to live.
Yeah, like I felt like that for sure. Swayze wanted him to be on the team.
Yeah, totally.
Didn't he? He wants you to turn him.
Yeah, I mean, I think that was, that seemed to be like, you know, right. It's like, this is not helping you rob the bank, but it is part of your MO to see if you can absorb more people into this gang.
Right.
You know? Yeah, and you could definitely tell that they were like, you know.
They had a connection.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of the other love story of the movie.
It really like is.
Between Johnny Utah and Bodhi.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's definitely a you know, yes, there is that love story going on too.
Yeah. That's interesting because I never really kind of put that all together until watching it last night.
And they like – and they spare each other so much in this. Like there are so many chances where one could have killed the other one, but they stop at the last second.
Yeah.
You know, Keanu not shooting him in the alley. I think at the end it's like he – you know, Bodhi is drowning him and lets him up. But there's this moment about like they just can't end it, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, they just have to keep themselves in this cycle.
Yeah, he well, you know, they have the great shootout at the airport.
Yes.
Where basically everybody dies but them.
Yeah, boy, this is a real bloodbath. I really forgot how many main characters just eat it in the end of this movie.
Yeah, and even James LaGrosse, they, you know, he doesn't quite die yet, but his plan, you know, Bodhi's plan is, all right, you've got two bullets to the chest, but we're going to parachute you down into Mexico with a bag full of money.
I know, and he hands him a big gun, too.
He's like, you're going to be just fine.
Yeah.
So this plan is solid.
I know, the guy just kind of flops out of the plane, too.
That was a funny part, actually.
Yeah,
he was
know.
Like, whoa.
Whoa, okay, bye. I know, I'm sure skydivers take issue with some stuff in this movie.
Yeah.
But, you know.
It's a cool moment, though, when
all
Keanu
in the, all
jumps
in the
out.
Service of fun. Yeah.
Yeah. Without a shoot. Like
without a shoot.
He says, fuck it.
Yeah.
That's one of the great moments.
I know. Yeah. He does say, fuck it. And then,
he literally says, fuck it.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, they have that one, you know, part of the whole one-upmanship of, like, who's more extreme.
Right.
Like, that carries to its final conclusion there with the parachuting.
Yeah.
Like, they literally have a conversation while they're falling to their death.
And then, yeah, and then I think at the end, Patrick Tracy says, you're one radical son of a bitch.
Yeah. It's great.
And then here's a weird part in that, though. I mean, I think they keep going back to Keanu's trick knee.
Right.
Because that's what kept him out of football.
Right.
And then, you know, I think later on in the movie, he injures it.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and after they skydive with two men, one parachute, and hit the ground.
Yeah.
Patrick Swayze gets up to get away, and Keanu's knee acts up.
Right.
It's like, that's right. – like, you have so many other injuries at this point. Like,
right. But he's like, no, it's the old
college. Oh, my knee.
But it ends like – and the only way it could end.
Yeah.
That great final scene with at the 50-year storm.
Yeah, he finally finds that wave he's been chasing all his life.
Yeah.
And Keanu lets him go to have one last ride.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And it's cool when he catches up to him and he tells him, like, I was, like, a week behind you in Sumatra, and
mm-hmm.
I just missed you here, and, like, his hair's long now. And
yeah.
So, like, you get this real sense that he's been, you know, on this mission.
There's a whole other movie there.
There is.
Of, like, Keanu tailing Swayze to surf spots.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Oh, they should have made that movie.
I know, right? There's so much more Point Break to be explored, I think. It's. I mean, you know, obviously I will have the cold take that there are too many sequels and reboots, but come on, let's mine this shit. It's rich.
Did you see the remake?
Yeah, I did. It's
was
bad.
It just the
it's
worst
so
thing ever?
So boring. Yeah, it's really boring. There's a remake in 2015.
Right.
And I think it has the dubious honor of being one of the, like, lowest grossing movies of that year.
Really?
I think it really released it on Christmas Day even.
Huh.
I watched it on HBO when it kind of came out later. And the extreme sports stuff is really beautifully shot. I think it was all shot, you know, with IMAX in mind.
Right.
So there's, like, wingsuit stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think all that is really cool to look at, but it seems like just a, you know, a demo for a flat screen TV in Best Buy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just like, look at this. And then the story is so boring. Everybody is such a nothing. All the actors are such nothings. And I think, you know, like we were saying, part of what makes this movie so great is that, like, there's all these cool, fun actors mm-hmm. acting in this,
yeah.
you know, in this kind of corny action movie. So, yeah, they really, like, just pick good-looking zeros to play all the characters.
Right.
And it is not funny. It's not funny. That's what people like about Point Break. They don't—
for sure.
People aren't— I mean, the action is cool. The skydiving is cool. But they're not— the reason it's a classic movie is not that.
Yeah.
You know? So I think they really just missed the point of Point Break.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
Yeah, if it didn't have a sense of humor about itself, then it's just—
yeah, I know. It's—
schlock.
It's, yeah, it just completely— yeah, it just completely did not know what people like about the first one, so.
All right, you got anything else on PB?
Man, I don't know. It's great. I don't know if there's a nice Criterion Blu-ray of it out there somewhere, but it seems like, yeah, Criterion, get on that.
I would like to see some behind-the-scenes shit.
Me too, yeah.
I do have one more line in here.
Please.
When Bodhi is faced with Keanu at the end in the airplane, he said, "I know you want me so bad. It's like acid in
it's
your
like
mouth."
It's like acid. Oh, yes. I know.
I was like,
very erotic.
Mean?
It's like acid in your mouth. My, kind of playing with that dynamic where Swayze is so much more articulate than his gang.
Mm-hmm.
There's this great moment in the van on the way to the last jump, which mm-hmm. has like five classic lines in it.
Yeah.
That van ride has so full of great dialogue.
Uh-huh.
It has, "I am an FBI agent."
Yeah.
Swayze says, "Why be a servant to the law when you can be its fucking master?"
Yeah.
And then his goon turns around and just goes, "Fucking A." It's so good.
I love it, man.
Yeah.
There's definitely some James Cameron going on there.
Of course.
All right, buddy. We finished with five questions.
Yes.
What's the first movie you remember seeing in a theater?
Ooh, boy. I think it might be— Disney's Aladdin.
Okay.
What year was that?
I don't know.
I had to have seen movies in theaters before that. It's the first trip to a movie theater that I really remember well.
Okay. Well, this is the first one you remember. So.
Yeah. And the first one I saw alone was Honey, I Blew Up the Kid.
Oh.
Yeah.
Nice.
First movie I saw without parents.
Okay. Was it just you, or was it— did you—
I think
have a
so. I think they dropped me off at the mall. I think mom shopped and then came back to get me when it was over.
Nice. First R-rated movie?
RoboCop 2.
Oh.
Yeah, and I have not seen it since,
mm-hmm.
but there is this scary image of a brain in a jar that's just burned into my brain.
Yeah.
And I think it really scared me,
uh-huh.
the brain in the jar. anyway, no, I've been meaning to go back and rewatch RoboCop 2 because I like RoboCop 1 a lot.
That's great.
I've seen that.
That was Joe Randazzo's pick.
Really?
We did this like a year ago.
Oh, nice. I should listen to that.
Yeah, it's good.
Yeah, RoboCop's great. And again, just a great movie that is kind of at once a cool action movie and kind of a commentary on them, I think.
Yeah.
It's a cold take.
And
you know?
It has a sense of humor.
Yeah, it's very funny.
Yeah,
yeah, but I should revisit two and see if that brain is as scary as I remember it.
Will you walk out of a bad movie?
I've walked out of two movies. Usually, no. I usually kind of like— – I mean, I kind of— – you know, growing up with Mystery Science Theater
mm-hmm.
as I did, watching a bad movie is kind of fun.
Yeah.
I even kind of like it, especially if you're with people and you can kind of
yeah.
goof on it. It's— – Yeah, sometimes a bad movie is fun and they can be interesting too.
Right.
It's like, what went wrong? But I think if the people I'm with are having a bad time, I am more likely to walk out.
Okay.
The two I remember walking out of is one in high school. It is a Gabriel Byrne horror movie called Stigmata. It is about the concept of stigmata.
Vague
where people,
recollection.
Yeah,
of
people,
that.
People, you know, kind of through miracles get Christ's wounds.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was very scary, but I think the people I was with were very religious and were insulted by it.
Oh.
So we left and got our money back.
Because God.
Yes, because of God. I think we – yeah, I can remember the friends I was with going up to the ticket counter and saying that the movie was blasphemous and
we
needed our money back.
Wow.
Again, something else I've been meaning to revisit. I should rewatch Stigmata and see if it was actually – you know,
blasphemous.
See if it was actually blasphemous. I think it probably was. Not that there's necessarily something wrong with making a blasphemous movie.
Sure.
And then the other one, and I know this will make me either a hero or a villain to the listeners.
Mm-hmm.
I realize this is a loaded one to talk about.
Oh, wow.
But I walked out of Tiny Furniture. The Lena Dunham's.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know if it was her first movie.
I think so.
It was kind of the progenitor to Girls.
Yeah,
it was
kind
of the,
I saw that.
I saw it on a date, and I think I was not liking it, and my date hated it. So I think we left Tiny Furniture before the third act. I did go on to really like Girls. I watched Girls to the end, so I don't. You
know, I loved Girls.
Yeah, I do not hate the output of Lena Dunham. Unless you hate her, then I also hate it. Don't yell at me online. I know Lena Dunham is the most loaded celebrity to talk about. Maybe loaded
sure.
2 years ago, but I know it's so tough to talk about her because she inflames passions in both directions.
Yeah, yeah.
But yes, Tiny Furniture I did not like, but have liked some of her subsequent work.
Yeah, for sure. I tailored this one to the guests. What movie? Let me see here. All right. How about this? What movie? If movies had a writer's room like a lot of TV does, what movie would you have loved to have been a writer for?
Oh, that's a fun one. That's a really fun one. Boy, recently, another cold take coming your way. Sure, that Spider-Verse movie was good, right?
Oh man,
that was a really fun movie.
So great,
and it felt like that had a real brain trust behind it.
Uh-huh.
You know, I think you had, you know, Lord Miller of the Lego movie, but definitely there's so much Marvel Comics in there.
Mm-hmm.
I think Dan Slott, the Spider-Man writer, had some input on that, or
definitely
it was at least based on some of his Spider-Man stories. So yeah, boy, that was such a fun movie, and it definitely felt like they were throwing the kitchen sink in there.
Yeah.
So yeah, and I think the best, you know, the best case scenario of a writer's room is you do feel like things are packed with ideas,
mm-hmm.
you know. So yeah, that's definitely one where it just felt like that was probably such a pleasure to just, you know, spew out all of your ideas and see how you can make it work on screen.
Great answer. And finally, movie going 101. What's your movie ritual? Where do you sit? What do you get?
Actually, I think I heard I'm gonna copy a former guest's answer.
Oh, okay.
And I think it's probably something you get a lot is I like sitting by that bar, you know, the railing.
Sure, between the two sections.
Yeah, I like to put my feet up on that bar.
Uh-huh.
So I try and get a seat next to the railing. Nothing too bonkers. I like popcorn with just a dab of butter.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that movie theater butter has the ability to ruin your day stomach-wise.
Yeah.
But if you can just – if you can get just the right amount on it, it's – you know, it's a razor's edge.
Right.
Much like the characters in Point Break.
Right.
Walk the edge between life and death. Nice. I will walk the edge with movie theater butter trying to put exactly the right amount on. Popcorn, Cherry Coke if they got it.
Oh, okay.
It's the only time I drink full sugar soda.
Mm-hmm.
When I'm in a movie. And yeah, I don't go to too many movies by myself. I will like watch movies at home, but as far as going to the theater, I usually try and get somebody to go with me. I don't know why. I usually have fun when I go by myself, but it's not something I do a lot.
All right.
So,
good stuff, man.
That's it.
All right. Thanks, Jordan.
Thank you.
All right, everyone. I had a good time talking to Jordan. He's so much fun. What a good guy. I'm glad we are pals, and I'm glad he agreed to give up some of his time to come in the studio there in Hollywood and talk Point Break with me. What a fun, fun movie. You can follow Jordan on Twitter. He's a great follow. Jordan_Morris. Or support him by listening to Jordan Jesse Go on the Max Fun Network. And certainly check out Bubble on the Max Fun Network. Such a good, good show. If you like comedy, if you like sci-fi, and you like silliness, you're going to love Bubble. It's really good stuff. So big thanks to Jordan. I'll see him again in June. We'll hang out and drink some beers together. Can't wait for that at Max FunCon this year. And thank you for listening. And until next time, I'm fucking surfing, man! Movie Crush is produced, engineered, edited, and soundtracked by Noel Brown and Ramsey Yunt at How Stuff Works Studios, Ponce City Market, Atlanta, Georgia.